Okay, so welcome back. Today's lecture is going to be a little bit technical, but let me tell you, it's super important stuff. It goes to the heart of quantum field theory. It's like doing brain surgery on quantum field theory, right? So it's a bit technical, but I hope to get across to you why this is important. And once we get the technical stuff behind us, then we can do things like Hawking radiation and, you know, the origin of structure in the universe. Okay, so remember where we are. The free Klein-Gordon quantum field in a generic curved space-time has to obey certain conditions, such as the hermeticity of the field and the canonically conjugate field. We abbreviate that with HC, these equations, and then the equations of motion, which say that it's the Hamiltonian that generates the evolution of the field and the evolution of the conjugate field. Once we plug in the actual Hamiltonian of the Klein-Gordon field, we obtain as the equations of motion two equations. One is the Klein-Gordon equation, which looks like this on curved spacetime, with G being the metric. And this relationship here, which now is a non-trivial equation of motion, it relates the canonically conjugate field to the time derivative and, in fact, also the space derivatives of phi. So this is a novelty here. Pi is no longer just phi dot. It's actually this expression, which consists of four terms, because nu is running from 0 to 3. So it includes, of course, the time derivative of phi, but generically, it will include also space derivatives. And this cost us a few lectures, right? It cost us like two lectures to get to this point, going to the Lagrangian, making everything covariant, and then the Legendre transform back gave us this. Now that we have that, we can quantize. This is what we did. And we found that, we also require, of course, not just the hermeticity condition and the equations of motion, but also the canonical commutation relations. So in particular, on all space-like hypersurfaces that we may call sigma, the canonical commutation relations must hold. So the phi have to commute at equal time, the pi have to commute at equal time, and the phi and pi have to commute like this at equal time. But of course, keep in mind that what is equal time depends on how you choose your coordinate system. And also keep in mind that phi and phi don't commute if t is sufficiently later than that t, right? Because then if they are time-like to each other or light-like to each other, then they may not commute. Okay. So then we want to solve the theory, which means we have to fulfill the hermeticity condition, the equations of motion, and the canonical commutation relations. What we showed is that the following ansatz succeeds. Namely, we can write the operator-valued field, Klein-Gordon field, as a linear combination of operators that obey the canonical commutation relations between A and A dagger, and so-called mode functions in front of them. The setup was chosen, the ansatz was chosen in such a way that the hermeticity condition is obeyed without thinking, because this is the Hermitian conjugate of that. Clearly, phi dagger is phi. So we get the hermeticity condition for free just by writing it down in this way. Also, we get the equations of motion for free if we choose all of these mode functions, uk and uk star, to be solutions to the classical Klein-Gordon equation. That is to say, if they are number-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, then because the Klein-Gordon equation is linear, and this is all linear, if each one of them obeys the Klein-Gordon equation, the whole thing obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. And the A and A dagger are not time-dependent, they're just fixed operators that obey these commutation relations, so they don't mess with the validity of the Klein-Gordon equation here. So by writing down these ansatz, we get for free the hermeticity condition and the equations of motion, the Klein-Gordon equation, and then the pi we simply define through the second equations of motion, right? Once we have the phi hat, we get the pi hat this way. So we have pi hat, phi hat, equations of motion, and Hermeticity condition. What's still missing is, the canonical commutation relations. And that should be expected to be the difficult part, right? Because the Klein-Gordon equation is not hard to solve in principle classically, but the quantum part is the difficult part. So for that, we will make use of the fact that these guys can be chosen to obey these canonical commutation relations. And of course, once we have operators that obey these commutation relations, we can build an entire Hilbert space representation automatically by saying, okay, we take the vector that's annihilated by these, and then we create states by applying the A dagger multiple times on that, so we get a whole Hilbert space with inner product. We did all this before. However, all of that doesn't guarantee that the phi hat and the pi hat are obeying the canonical commutation relations. No, in order for the phi hat so defined and the pi hat so induced to obey the desired canonical commutation relations, we have to impose an extra condition on those UK mode functions, on those UK mode functions. Namely, what we found is that in order for the phi pi to obey the canonical commutation relations, the UK have to obey this equation here, which is the Wronskian condition, simply obtained by plugging this answer together with what we get for pi hat into the commutator between phi and pi, requiring this to be I Dirac delta, and then working things out using the commutator between A and A dagger, then you get this equation here. So, what we have is, so far, that in order to obey the Hermeticity condition, this ansatz will do it. If we also want the equations of motion, this ansatz will do it, as long as we choose all of those mode functions to be classical number-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. In order to also have the Wronskian condition, the UK mode functions have to obey this too. This is a condition that forces that we have infinitely many of those guys. You see, if that wasn't necessary, we could just have one solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. Then we don't have to sum over this, right? We could just have one of those solutions. But this condition can only be obeyed if we have infinitely many of those UK. And the reason is that each UK is an ordinary, well-behaved, tame, differentiable, smooth function. But on the right-hand side, we have the Dirac delta. So for smooth functions, differentiated, added, and subtracted, to give you a Dirac delta, you better have infinitely many of them. So quantization forces that. Remember from the beginning of the course, when we discussed whether there are finite dimensional representations of the XP commutation relations? There aren't. And here we see a similar thing in quantum field theory. You can solve the thing with mode functions that are classical, but you need infinitely many of them. Okay, so we have to overcome this giant mountain here. We have to climb that mountain, which is to find such an infinite number of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation that somehow magically sum up to the Dirac delta. So we were wondering, is this even possible? Now, to show that this is possible, we invoked Darboux's theorem. We introduced an inner product on the space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, classical number-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. We introduced an inner product there, and we found that it is a symplectic inner product. Now, Darboux's theorem tells us that we can almost diagonalize that. We get this box form with 0, 1, minus 1, 0. All right, so we did this, and then we complexified it, and then we got this inner product, which was not positive definite. It looked like the inner product of a Hilbert space, but not really, because we can have negative norms in that as well. Anyway, we used the Darboux theorem, to prove at the end of the day that yes, we can always do it. We can always find infinitely many classical solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation such that this Wronskian condition is obeyed. That's the bottom line. Can do it. The proof is. Now, before we move on, let's ask, having now proven that the canonical commutation relations can be obeyed, and therefore we can solve the quantum field theory, we have to make sure of one thing. We only ensured that the canonical commutation relations hold at one time. And then we got the Wronskian condition, and we proved we can fulfill it. But does that mean that the canonical commutation relations are going to be obeyed for all times? Or do we perhaps have to enforce this over and over and over again at every point in time? Now, luckily, the canonical commutation relations are always preserved in a quantum theory. And here we will see that this is the case too. Now, there's a bigger picture to this that I also wrote a paper on some time ago. Remember, in general in physics, whenever you have a symmetry, you get a conservation law. That's Noether's theorem. Now, the canonical commutation relations are conserved, as we will now prove. Do you have any hint, any suggestion to what symmetry might be behind that conservation? What symmetry could it be that leads to the conservation of the canonical commutation relations? It's the symmetry that it doesn't matter in which basis in the Hilbert space you work. In quantum mechanics, if the Hilbert space is n-dimensional, you have the unitary group un acting on that Hilbert space, and you can, you know, change your basis whichever way you want, get the same quantum theory. And that translates into the conservation of the canonical commutation relation. Now, let's see how that operates here. So the conservation of the canonical commutation relations is in quantum field theory, as in any quantum theory, also in first quantization, it is implied by the self-adjointness of the time evolution operator H of the Hamiltonian. You see, in quantum theory, the time evolution is always generated by the Hamiltonian. E to the power I times, and then the integral over the Hamiltonian. If the Hamiltonian is constant in time, then that integral is trivial, and you don't need the time ordering operator, but in general, you may need the time ordering operator here. Either way, what we obtain is that the time evolution operator is unitary. And that is guaranteed by the fact that the Hamiltonian, constant or time dependent, is self-adjoint. So the time evolution operator is unitary. Now, this allows us to express the time evolution of the observables, such as the field, through the time evolution operators. So, for example, the field at some time t, at some location x, is given by the field at an earlier time, and then time evolved by the time evolution operator. But the time evolution operator is the time evolution operator of our quantum field theory. And the same is true for the conjugate field. We can get what it does at a later time from what it did at an earlier time just by applying the time evolution operator left and right. Right? The usual adjoint action of time evolution. And now let's see what happens to the canonical commutation relations. Here we have the commutator between phi and pi at some late time t. And we can express that in this way. We can express the field at the late time t in terms of u, phi, u inverse, where phi is at the earlier time. And also the pi is time evolved from t naught to the time t. Okay, so we say phi and pi at the late time t can be expressed in terms of phi and pi at an earlier time t naught using the time evolution operator. But you see, what happens here is that this commutator is this term times that term minus that term times this term. But you see, when they multiply, this u inverse cancels that u. So what we obtain here is that we can actually pull this time evolution operator can pull it outside of the commutator. So we get U commutator U inverse. But the commutator is the Dirac delta at early times. By assumption, this is where we enforce the Runskin condition and use Abu's theorem, etc. So here we got the commutator right. So it was I Dirac delta. But of course, that's just number value. It is not an operator. So we can pull this U and this U inverse together. They annihilate itself, each other, and then we get just that. Which means that the hermeticity of the Hamiltonian guarantees unitary time evolution, which then guarantees conservation of the commutation relation. So it's a general feature in any quantum theory, no matter how often you quantize, that the canonical commutation relations, once enforced, will always hold. Now this is going to be a bit technical, and I'm not sure how much we want to go into the details of the proof, but it's important that you get why it's important and what we're doing here. When we did the quantization, we chose a coordinate system for space-time. And once we have chosen a coordinate system, we have implicitly defined space-like hypersurfaces of equal time, right? So you hold the time variable fixed, and then you look at all those events that have the same time coordinate. And that gives us a space-like hypersurface. On that space-like hypersurface, we enforce the canonical commutation relations using the Wronskian condition and Dabu's theorem, etc. And we've also just shown that once we've imposed it on one of those time slices, the canonical commutation relations will be preserved through the evolution. But now we have to ask, what if we had chosen a different coordinate system to start with? In that case, our slicing of space-time into equal time surfaces, that foliation of space-time into equal time surfaces would have been different. Our notion of what is equal time would be different. Would all be space-like hypersurfaces, but different ones. Would we get a differently quantized theory or the same? So what if we changed our space-like hypersurfaces? Would we get a different theory or not? So what if we change coordinate system, and therefore if we changed our choices of space-like hypersurfaces? So in particular, what if we changed the initial space-like hypersurface on which we first imposed the canonical commutation relations? Now the proposition is, it doesn't matter. Fortunately, magically, it is possible to do this. It is possible to quantize in one coordinate system, choosing one space-like hypersurface, and you get the same theory as if you had chosen a different coordinate system, a different space-like hypersurface. And to see this is a little harder than what we just showed, namely that the unitarity of the time evolution preserves commutation relations. So the overall idea is this, and it goes into some pretty involved differential geometry to prove this. I have all the details in the notes here, but maybe we'll just skip over some of the details. So overall, remember how the quantization proceeded. We started with a symplectic form that was an inner product on the space of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, of the number-valued Klein-Gordon equation. I should say, before we go into all of those details, I hope you've looked into the project description, because you will see that the project is quite different from the center part of this course. Namely, the project has nothing to do with these things. It's about simulating quantum fluctuations and so on. You know, this is meant to be a grad course for grown-ups. You know, this is not about testing you, but, you know, about learning. And so the technical things here are not in their details important. You may later find in your graduate work, for example, or whenever you write a paper, that you may want to go back to some of the technical things, and you can. But for the moment, in particular for the project, these technicalities are not so important. So don't panic if you don't get all of the details of the differential geometry now. All right. So remember what we did for the quantization. We, to prove that quantization is possible, what we did is we looked at the space of all solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. To start with, the real-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. And we introduced the inner product between them. So if H and F are solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, then this is an inner product. Here, we integrate it over a space-like hypersurface. And we can give a name to all of this, what we integrate over. It is, technically speaking, a three-form, a differential three-form, because whenever you do an integral over a space-like hypersurface of three dimensions, what you're integrating is a three-form. If you're not entirely familiar, I mean, those of you who have been to my course last term will know all of this by heart, but if you haven't, don't panic. So the three-form is this, of course. It's just the integrand here. And then so just a sec. This was the contravariant vector field. Here we go. This is a contravariant vector field, which is contracted with this measure. And what we obtain is then a three-form. And the three-form can be written, I mean, that is what the entire integrand was, this three-form. And it is the inner derivation of the volume form, in case you remember these things. So what we need to show now is this. We did the quantization on one space-like hypersurface and then relied on unitarity of the evolution that the canonical commutation relations were preserved. But the initial step was to show that the canonical commutation relations could be obeyed on one space-like hypersurface. Let's call it sigma. And now what we want to show is that if we had chosen a different space-like hypersurface, namely, let's say this way, where we keep it at infinity, we keep it the same. But at finite distances, we modify that. This is a space-like hypersurface. That's a space-like hypersurface. We could have chosen to quantize there. And we can show it is implied that the quantization would be exactly the same if we can show that the inner product on the space of solutions is the same. So if we can show that that it doesn't matter whether we calculate this symplectic form, this inner product, on that space-like hypersurface or on that space-like hypersurface, then we're done. Because that proves it didn't matter which space-like hypersurface we chose, we got the same quantization. So what we can do is we integrate over both sigma and sigma prime. So we integrate over all of this. And the volume, the space-time volume that is enclosed in here, we call B. So the boundary of B is then the first space-like hypersurface on which we first quantized. And here we have sigma prime, which is an alternative space-like hypersurface on which we may alternatively quantize. So Stokes' theorem now says that if we integrate over both space-like hypersurfaces, our inner product of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, then by Stokes' theorem, the integral over the boundary of the three-form is the same as integrating over the bulk, over this four-dimensional volume of space-time, of the exterior derivative of that three-form, which is a four-form. This is a four-dimensional region, and we're integrating a four-form here. Now, if we can show, as we will show, that the exterior derivative of that three-form vanishes, so if this is zero, we can show that this is zero, then that is zero, which means that this integral plus that integral is zero. But they differ by a minus sign because one of them is outward facing, the other one is inward facing. So therefore, this minus that is equal to zero. So therefore, the integrals with both surfaces pointing the same direction are the same. So what we need to show, in order to show that quantization is independent of which space-like hypersurface we first quantize. We just need to show that the exterior derivative of J tilde is vanishing. And this is just the argument that I already said in words, namely if dj tilde is zero, then we have that this is zero, that is zero, and if we fix the orientation of the space-like hypersurface, then it means that they are the same. Okay, so now we have to show this. We need to show that the exterior derivative of this free form is vanishing. Again, this should be easy for those of you who have taken my course last term. You shake your head, not easy, but familiar, right? Yeah, all right, so maybe not easy, but familiar. All right, so the exterior derivative of this three form is the exterior derivative of the inner derivation of the volume form. That's the divergence. The divergence can be written this way. In case you haven't seen the divergence this way, this is just a covariant version of a divergence. If you did this on Minkowski space, where the metric was trivial, then this would be just a 1, and this would be just the sum of the derivatives, right? It would be the time derivative of J naught plus, you know, d by dx1 of J1, etc., what we usually consider to be a divergence. Okay, now we have to evaluate this. Now, the J, remember, was this contravariant vector, and here is what it exactly was. It was the integrand of that symplectic form. We have to apply this derivative here on that. And we use the product rule here. Namely, we get that the derivative in the direction of d by dx mu acts on f here, or it acts on the rest. And here it acts on h, or it acts on the rest. Let's factor things in this way. So what happens if we get, if let's look at the terms that we obtain when we differentiate df. Well, then we get a df and a dh. And here we have a derivative on h and f, so we get a dh and a df. You see, these two terms cancel each other out because we simply have a df dh, dh df. So these terms coming from the product rule cancel each other out. But there are other terms, namely where the derivative is not acting on the f, but is acting on the rest. And here too, those terms don't cancel. So the first two terms that cancel are these two, and the surviving terms are those two. But then, I don't expect you to know this by heart, but this is the D'Alembert operator. It happens to be the D'Alembert operator that we get here, and also what we get here. But by the Klein-Gordon equation, D'Alembert operator acting on the field is also, like h is one of the solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, is also m squared times the field. So therefore, this is m squared times h, and this is m squared times f. And therefore, this term is also equal to that term by virtue of the Klein-Gordon equation. That's important. So what we show here is that indeed, it's all the quantization is independent of the space-like hypersurface, etc. But we see that an important input went into this, namely that we're not just dealing with any functions. No, they have to be solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. Then this is true. I mean, obviously, it couldn't be true for all functions, because if they could have any behavior from one space-like hypersurface to the other space-like hypersurface, how would the integrals be related? Right? They are related because they are solution. The integrand is made out of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, and that makes for that independence here. See, it all looks like it's a huge conspiracy here going on, but I think what's really happening is that fundamentally these things have to work out because what we do is covariant, and we can see this, and we will see this at the end of this course when we do it in the Feynman way, where we do everything with actions and Lagrangians. So there we see, yeah, we can just quantize these things and it works out. But here we force ourselves to do it the Hamiltonian way with this Legendre transform. And then nothing is obviously covariant. So we have to prove tediously that the covariance is preserved and it doesn't matter you know, whether we use this coordinate system or another coordinate system to quantize. But things have to fall into place because there is a covariant way to do it. If there wasn't a covariant way to do it, this would be a miracle that it cancels out. All right. Okay, so we've now seen that if we impose the canonical commutation relations on one space-like hypersurface, then we get the same theory as if we deform the space-like hypersurface, like choosing another coordinate system. And we've seen that once we've imposed the canonical commutation relations on one space-like hypersurface in one coordinate system, then the unitarity of the time evolution makes sure that they will always hold the canonical commutation. All right. Okay. Now, remember, we also proved that there exists always a bunch of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation that we can put together in our ansatz to obey the Wronskian condition and therefore have the canonical commutation relations. So we proved the existence using Dabou's theorem. Let us look at how this looks like in practice, in an actual example. How do these mode functions actually look like? For example, on Minkowski space. Remember, we solved the Klein-Gordon quantum field theory before we went into all of this theory. So we must have somehow figured out what the mode functions are without quite knowing what they have to obey, not in this general framework. I mean, we were just initially just going for hermeticity, canonical commutation relations, and equations of motion. We didn't do it in this fully generic way. What did we find from Minkowski space? Well, we found the following solution. We found that the Klein-Gordon quantum field can be written in this way, where we have an integral over R3, an integral D3K, and 1 over omega K. Here we have the A in a dagger. And now we notice, aha, these must be the mode functions. More precisely, this times all that stuff before, right? So the function in front of the A in a dagger. These guys are the mode functions, depending on space and time. So the mode function UK is this one. Now remember that in general, a generic curved space-time, the label K that labels the modes of our quantum field has no particular meaning. It's just to label the infinitely many of them that we need in order to linearly combine the Dirac delta. In Minkowski space, the K happened to be the momentum. But we should not be surprised that in general it might be something else. So let's see if how these mode functions here, right? Here's the mode function. Let's see whether they indeed obey the Wronskian condition and how that comes about. Because remember that we use all of them for all k, infinitely many of them, sum them all up or integrate them all up, and then we expect the Dirac delta on the right-hand side for the commutation relations. So let's see. In Minkowski space, of course, the determinant of the metric, the absolute value of the determinant of the metric is 1, and the metric indeed, the metric 0 nu is the Kronecker delta of nu 0. So therefore, things simplify, and the Wronskian condition is simply, on the left-hand side, is simply this expression. Remember that in principle, the Wronskian condition is this. It says that this stuff is equal to Dirac delta, where we have the square root of g and the g naught nu. But in Minkowski space, that is just the Kronecker delta of 0 nu, and this is just 1. So let's see, what do we have? We have here the left-hand side of the Wronskian condition is this. Now, we can substitute in what the mode function is for Minkowski space. It was all of this stuff, right? And you get factors of minus omega k from differentiating here the mode function. The mode function has this I omega kt in it. So if you do a time derivative, then we get an omega k. down. That's why we get this and this here. Now you see that this omega k cancels that one, and the same here. So we end up with just these exponentials here. But what happens if we integrate these 3k, a constant, times the exponential? Well, that is going to give us a Dirac delta. And that's what we need to have on the right-hand side of the commutation relations in the Wronskian condition. Okay, so in Minkowski space, it all works out. But now, of course, we understand it much more generally, and that these mode functions could be something much more complicated. In fact, I just published a paper with my former student, Robert Johnson, and collaborators. And that's a different paper. With Kochi Yamaguchi, a student from Japan that was visiting here, and a few collaborators. And we chose for Minkowski space different mode functions. Because remember, we showed here existence of a set of mode functions that allows us to quantize. But as I mentioned before, and as we will discuss now in more detail, that's not the only way. You can quantize differently too. You can use other mode functions too. And we used other mode functions. Now, the purpose why we did this is the following. Imagine you have a quantum field, and you can imagine it again with the picture that we had at the beginning of the course. You have a cork, and you make some waves with it in the quantum field, and then these waves propagate, and then somewhere else there might be another cork. And after a while, the waves reach this other cork, and in this way you have a communication channel between the two corks in the water. You can do this with the quantum field. You can have, for example, an atom here, which is in an excited state. It might emit light, which creates a perturbation in the quantum field, which then propagates and can be picked up by another atom, for example. And we wanted to isolate the information that a system imprints on the quantum field, an atom, a molecule, or whatever it might be. You couple it to the quantum field, it imprints some information into the quantum field. And then we wanted to track how that information is traveling. And so we were defining modes that capture exactly the perturbation that was created by coupling a system to the quantum field. And then we had the field, the quantum field, decomposed into those modes that capture the information from the coupling and the rest. And you can always do that. And in this way, you can, in a contained way, we call that quantum information capsule, we can, in a contained way, track exactly the part of the field that carries information, as opposed to the part of the field that's ignorant. Yeah.
So the rest is just noise?
Well, the quantum field has also noise, of course. That's what you calculated in your project. That's right. Yeah, and it's a whole field of study, how you can communicate through a quantum field. Have a quantum system, first quantized quantum system, interacting with a quantum field using perturbations that then spread, and then another quantum system picks that up. And you get a quantum channel. You can send classical information to the quantum channel, but you can also send entanglement to that quantum channel. That's quantum channel capacity. It's a whole field. And then the question is always, how much noise is there? How much noise is there because of quantum fluctuations? It was actually a student of mine, Matthew Klisch, who in his master's thesis, we were the first to consider that channel. And by the way, every communication is, of course, of that form. Because we can't communicate in any other way than through quantum fields, right? I mean, you might think we communicate by sending emails or whatever, but yeah, it's always quantum fields. Even electrons are described by quantum fields, right? Everything is. Anyway, so even in Minkowski space, we don't have to use that mode decomposition. And the freedom of choosing different mode decompositions of the field, different bunches of UKs, you always need infinitely many of them, but difference of them, that can be important. Because it, depending on what you want to do with the field, You may want to choose the one or the other decomposition. You're describing the same physics, but in different ways. All right. So the summary so far is this. To solve the quantum field theory of a Klein-Gordon field on curved space-time is to solve three conditions, hermeticity, equations of motion, kinematic, and commutation relations. And in order to fulfill these three conditions, we make this ansatz. We write the field as this linear combination here with mode functions that are still to be determined. This is what we will call A for ansatz. Now, we showed that if space-time is globally hyperbolic, remember we needed that globally hyperbolic condition in order for the symplectic form to be well-defined and global hyperbolicity means that you have a well-posed Cauchy problem. You can pose initial conditions and then the further evolution is fully determined. We showed that if space-time is globally hyperbolic, then there always exists a set of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation UK such that this ansatz succeeds via Darboux's theorem, etc. But does there exist only one such set of solutions? Well, I gave it away, of course, already. No, there are infinitely many of such solutions. Let's see why that is, that we have infinitely many of those. No, it's another kind of freedom that we have. You're all used to being free to choose bases in the Schrödinger equation, no? Position bases, momentum bases, and so on. You're free, you know that in general relativity, you can choose your coordinate system whichever way you want. Here, it turns out, you can choose your mode functions whichever way you want. But just like some coordinate systems are more useful than others, some mode decompositions are more useful than others. And that's what is called a mode decomposition, right? If we write the field in this way, this is a mode decomposition. Because here we have modes, and then we have a Nerdegger operators. So we can do that. We can write the same field phi. We can write as mode functions u, a plus u star a dagger. Or if we write it with different mode functions, then to be fair, we have to write here sum over, let's say, u tildes, and then a tildes, u tilde star, and a dagger star, a dagger tilde. Right? Because if those guys change, then those have to change too. So you have to give them a different name then. Okay, how can we see that this is, that the mode decomposition is not unique? Well, remember that at the heart of this, mathematically speaking, is a symplectic form for the, in the space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. Namely, if f and h are solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, then that integral gives us a number, which is, you know, symplectic, it's anti-symmetric in interchanging f and h. And there was Darboux's theorem that said that in the space of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, we can always find a basis, Vn, such that this symplectic form takes this simple matrix form. Namely that this inner product is always zero, except here, close to the diagonal, we have this 0, 1, minus 1, 0 boxes, right? That's all. This is the Darboux normal form of symplectic forms. And then we said, okay, these f and h are real-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. We can now upgrade this to get complex-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. If you remember, we can take the V2n and the plus I times V2n plus 1, complex solutions, and those guys are our mode functions. Right? The mode functions have to be complex-valued functions and never real-valued functions, because otherwise the ansatz would collapse. We could never have the Wronskian condition obeyed with real-valued mode functions. Remind me later. Remind me in 2 hours. That's good. Okay. Why? How do we make this big? Oh, there we go. Okay. Right, so we can put the symplectic form into this normal form here. And here comes the point, the Darboux bases are not unique. This is very different from self-adjoint or unitary operators. You can diagonalize them, and the eigenbasis is unique, except if you have degeneracies in the eigenvalues, right? But if they have a non-degenerate spectrum, the eigenbasis is unique. But not for symplectic forms. For symplectic forms, there are plenty of eigenbases. So for example, let's say we have a two-dimensional system only, simplest case. Then let's say that V1 and V2 are a Darboux basis, so that the inner product, then the symplectic product, then takes this box form. Then let's ask, can we change bases? So we get the new vectors Vi being Q being a matrix acting on the vector V bar, such that this symplectic form stays the same. So if we apply Q transpose on this, and then Q, is that this the same? Right? So can we have changes of bases which leave this the same? If you are not entirely sure why a change of bases, Q, transforms a matrix in this way, it's here in the box. It's just linear algebra. Just put the reminder for you in this box over there. Okay, so the question is, can we do this? And it turns out, yes, we can. If we do a change of bases in this two-dimensional space with a change of bases matrix Q, which has entries A, B, C, D, then as long as these entries obey AD minus BC equal 1, which you may recognize as the condition that the determinant is 1, as long as the determinant is 1, this will be obeyed. And therefore, the symplectic form is preserved. So that means, yeah, you can get plenty of bases. There are plenty of Darboux bases, even in the simplest case, where you have just two dimensions. But remember, in general, for a quantum field, we have infinitely many dimensions. And the symplectic form has this 2x2 box here, and then there, and then there, and then there. You have these boxes on the, along the diagonal. And in general, you can change Darboux bases not only by mixing two dimensions of one box, but you can mix across the boxes too, as we will see. Right, here's a little exercise. Don't have to do it, don't have to hand it in or anything, don't worry. So remember that with respect to the Hermitian form that we then defined for the complex valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, we had that the inner product between the UNs and the UMs was the Kronecker delta. Between the UN stars and the UM stars, it was minus Kronecker delta. And the inner product between the starred and the unstarred ones was 0. Now we can ask, you see, these are the conditions that we need for our mode functions. Our mode functions obey that. Now, let's see if we can, if these form a basis in our space of mode functions, in our space of solutions to complex valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, we can now ask for the complexified version, the same question as we just asked in the real case. Can we do a change of bases that will mix these solutions, linear combinations of them, such that this condition is still obeyed? And the answer is yes. We can write, for example, a new set of bases vectors in the space of complex valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. We can write the new basis vectors as a linear combination of the old mode functions, U and U star, with coefficient matrices A and B. And then we can ask, well, what conditions do the matrices A and B have to obey such that from these old mode functions, we obtain new mode functions that are also eligible to be mode functions, namely that also have that inner product, which translates into the symplectic form having these boxes there. Right? And it turns out, that's a little exercise, that yes, you can preserve all of this if those matrices A and B obey the conditions that A over A minus B transpose B star equal to 1 and this and the other condition there. So again, not difficult to obey. So yes, there are many Davu bases, infinitely many. So remember our ansatz, that was equation A. It was this one. Now we know, not only can we solve it, there are infinitely many ways to do this. Namely, we can write our quantum field as some mode functions plus complex conjugate of these mode functions, etc. This is one way to do it. And if we succeed, we have solved all of the conditions, hermeticity, canonical commutation relations, equations of motion. But we may achieve the same goal using different mode functions. Right? And if the mode functions carry a bar, then the A in integers, we will also give a bar. You have to be careful. They are not going to be the same as the unbarred ones, right? Because this is the same. So if the mode functions change, these guys also have to change. But they always obey the same kind of commutation relation. Right, and then somebody else might come along and say, I have another bunch of mode functions that also work. Fine, that also works. So we can write our quantum field also in this way. Infinitely many ways to do this. And for example, from Minkowski space, we already saw what we can do there using plane waves. But then I told you about that paper that I recently wrote, where we chose different mode functions, which are useful even in Minkowski space, for example, for the purpose of tracking how information flows through a quantum field. However, a priori, we have to be a little careful here, because depending on whether we choose these mode functions with their A and A dagger operators, or those mode functions with their A and A dagger operators, well, we get, as far as the Hilbert space is concerned, if we construct the Hilbert space the usual way, we get different Hilbert bases, right? The state in the Hilbert space that's annihilated by that A, we may call the state zero, like vacuum, but may not be the vacuum state, but state zero. Whereas here, the state that's annihilated by the A bar may be called the state, you know, zero bar. And here, zero, two bar. And we'll have to find out how they are related to each other. And then here, if we apply the A dagger a few times on this zero state, we get, you know, basis vectors for our Hilbert space. Here too, if you apply the A bar dagger onto the zero bar, we get basis vectors in our Hilbert space. This basis is going to be different from that basis. It's going to be a transformation between them, a unitary transformation between them. There's going to be a Bogoliubov transformation between them. Okay. So, yeah, that's what I just said. If you apply A on that zero state, you get zero. If you apply A bar on what we may call the zero bar state, you get zero. That's just by definition. This is how we define those two vectors. And then we can define basis vectors in the Hilbert space using applications of A dagger or A dagger bar, as the case may be, on these vectors zero and zero bar. But how are they related? The question is, do these solutions of the quantum field theory describe different physics, or do they not? Do they perhaps differ by a mere change of basis in the Fock space, and so do they describe the same physics? The answer is yes, they describe the same physics, but you have to be careful because there are exceptions. So it depends. So first of all, let us assume an infrared and an ultraviolet cut off our quantum field theory. So we're looking at our quantum field in a box, which might be light years across, but a box, which means that the Fourier transform becomes a Fourier series. So we have only a countable number of Fourier modes. And then we apply also an ultraviolet cutoff, which is to say that we are not considering any wavelengths shorter than some value, which could be the Planck length, 10 to the minus 35 meters. So in this way, we have a discrete set of mode functions, right? We have a discrete set of Fourier modes. Sorry, we have a discrete set of Fourier modes, of a discrete set of momenta, and in fact a finite set of them, because of the ultraviolet cutoff. We do the Fourier series expansion, but only up to a certain max. So that means that we get only a finite number of mode oscillators, An and A dagger. An and An dagger. And it turns out that there's a theorem which covers the case of finitely many degrees of freedom. This is a theorem by Stone and von Neumann. So what they say is, imagine you have a Hilbert space, H, and in it you have operators X and P, and you have any number of them, but finitely many of them. So let's say you have X and P operators that obey the canonical commutation relations. Now assume, this is first quantization, right? But we will get to it, we will get to quantum field theory in a moment. So first quantization, you have some position, some momentum operators. Let's say you have 1 million particles, and you have 3 million position operators, 3 million momentum operators. In quantum field theory, infinitely many, except if you have an ultraviolet and an infrared cutoff. Then two, you have a huge number, but finite number of degrees of freedom. So now let's assume that in a Hilbert space H tilde, you have operators X tilde and P tilde, which also obey the canonical commutation relations. And let's say it's N of them in each case. And let's assume that these representations are irreducible, so that there are no invariant subspaces, there's no subspace on which they act trivially. Now, first of all, we can assume that the two Hilbert spaces are the same. I don't know if you're aware of that, but in quantum theory, all Hilbert spaces are the same. They are all the same size. Because there's only one kind of infinity that comes up in quantum theory regarding its the dimension of its Hilbert space. It's countable. In quantum theory, Hilbert spaces have countably infinite bases. There have been attempts to work with uncountably infinite bases, but that's non-standard stuff. In standard quantum theory, we work with countable bases. And in that case, one can prove that all these Hilbert spaces are isomorphic. There's always a unitary transformation between any two Hilbert spaces that have countable bases. Just map basis vector into basis vector for that purpose. All right, so first of all, we can assume that they act on the same Hilbert space, because they're just related by change of bases. There's a unitary in between them. Then, and so goes the theorem by Stone and von Neumann, then it turns out that the X tildes are just unitary transformations of the X's, and the P tildes are unitary transformations of the P's. In other words, you just have a change of bases there. That's all. Now, strictly speaking, there can be pathological cases. Stone-von-Neumann theorem, strictly speaking, doesn't concern the X and the P's, which are unbounded operators, because their eigenvalues go all the way from minus infinity to plus infinity, which are therefore functional analytically very subtle operators. No, instead, Stone and von Neumann deal with the exponentiated versions of the X and the P, e to the power I alpha X and e to the power I beta P. These guys are unitary operators. As such, they're bounded operators, because unitary operators have a spectrum that's always on a unit circle. So that's much safer, and for them, the theorem is true. But I don't know of any physical applications of the pathological cases. Maybe you find some, but I've never heard of one. Okay, so now if we apply this to ultraviolet and infrared regularized quantum field theory, where we also have a finite number of degrees of freedom only, then remember that we can define from the Einar Dagger operators X and P operators. We did this in lecture 2 or something like this. Or you could also, I mean, basically the X and the P's are the phi and the pi. And so what we find is that by Stone and von Neumann's theorem, we have that also in quantum field theory, the different mode decompositions of the field, the different mode functions, are all equivalent. They differ only by a change of bases. However, what if we do not have an infrared and ultraviolet cutoff? And I just give that to you as a word of caution. It's not something that, as far as I know, comes up in quantum field theory for curved space, at least not for the standard applications. It might be important in black hole physics, but who understands black hole physics? It's just, I think you need to know about this. Let's see. So let us consider the possibility that we cannot truncate to a finite number of degrees of freedom. So we truly have infinitely many mode operators, functions, infinitely many of these mode oscillators. Then the Stone von Neumann theorem doesn't apply. And you can ask, well, what physics would that correspond to? And it turns out this may have to do with the physics of phase transition. Phase transitions, strictly speaking, happen, mathematically speaking, happen only for infinitely large systems. In practice, of course, they happen also for finite size systems, such as, let's say you have a crystal of superconductor. Mathematically speaking, you get a phase transition only if that crystal is infinite in size. Only then do you have a discontinuity, for example, in the conductivity, in the derivative of the conductivity. But in practice, even a little grain of a superconductor is already so macroscopic, because it has so many particles, that it looks for the experimenter as if you had a discontinuity in there. But mathematically, it's much more convenient to deal with an infinite system, because then you have a clean phase transition there. Now, let's see the mathematics of having infinitely many degrees of freedom involved. And I just give you a hint of what can happen here. So imagine, for example, just a sec. I have to tell you that what can then happen is that you have mode decompositions that are not unitarily equivalent. So you don't have a unitary map from the one mode decomposition to the other mode decomposition. Let's see how that might happen, that suddenly there is no such unitary map. Imagine you have a quantum system with two states A and B, whose overlap, whose inner product is alpha. First quantization, just look at ordinary quantum systems, right? A and B. And alpha is, of course, some number between 0 and 1, let's say. Right? It could be a complex number, right? It was modulus up to 1. But let's say it's some real number between 0 and 1. Point is, they're not orthogonal. If they were orthogonal, the inner product would have to be 0. OK, so let's say the overlap is some finite value alpha between 0 and 1. Now, let's say we have n of the systems with state A and we have n copies of our system, and we have a state where all of the copies are in the state A, and we have a state of the system where all of the copies of the system are in the state B. Now, let's calculate the inner product now. Now, for that bigger system, the inner product between this state and that state is, of course, AB times AB times AB times AB n times. That's alpha to the power n. But you see what happens here? The inner product between this state and that state is much smaller than the inner product between that and that state, because it's alpha to the power n. Now, if n goes to infinity, with infinitely many copies of that system, if our crystal grows infinite in size, if infinitely many of them, then suddenly the inner product is 0. But that makes a difference, because suddenly those two states are orthogonal to each other, right? And now that means suddenly you can no longer use the one state, this one, to help linearly superpose that state. Because it now no longer has any component in the direction of that state. Now it's strictly orthogonal, right? So suddenly something becomes impossible that was possible for any finite end. And yeah, so that sort of thing can happen, and that can make it impossible to have unitary transformations then from one basis to the other, because there's the overlap between the basis vectors vanishes in this way. All right, so from now on and to the rest of the course, we will always assume that infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs are possible, and that Stone and von Neumann's theorem therefore applies, and that we have uniqueness. Therefore, we get to choose which mode functions we use, and we always describe the same physics. Right? So we can choose one set of mode functions or another, it doesn't matter. It's a matter of convenience, depending on what representation of our quantum field phi hat is more useful. For example, if in Minkowski space, phi hat could be represented the way we had it with those plane waves, fine. The advantage in this case is the using a traditional wave function with the plane waves here, is that when we apply the A operator, this one, on the zero vector, then it's annihilated, and the zero vector has a meaning. It's the no particle state, it's the vacuum state. On top of that, it has another meaning, it's the lowest energy state, which is great, useful to have. But then if, for example, you want to study how energy propagates through a quantum field, how information propagates through a quantum field, by coupling an excited atom to the quantum field and let it decay, then for that purpose, it may be useful to choose another mode decomposition. And then you have different operators, A bar and A bar dagger, and you get a vector zero bar. Now that vector zero bar is not going to be the ground state, not the lowest energy state, it's not the no particle state. And yet it's legal to write the field in this way. And it might be useful for other purposes. And later what we will find is that in a generic curved space-time, one observer may find it convenient to use one mode decomposition, another observer might find it convenient to use another mode decomposition, and another observer yet another one. For example, remember, we looked at the Unruh effect, lecture 8, and we found that for an accelerated observer, there are particles, where for an inertial observer, there aren't. Which means two different observers may not agree on which state in the Hilbert space is the vacuum state. This is the math of it. Because if one observer has one vacuum state, that means the vacuum state for that observer might be annihilated by an A operator. Another observer will have a different vacuum state annihilated by a different operator, A tilde. So correspondingly, they work with different mode functions. Right, okay, so here I'm just saying that once you've chosen your mode decomposition, you get for free a Hilbert basis in your Hilbert space, right? You get the corresponding zero vector, and then you apply your A dagger operators on that to get normalized basis vectors, and then you can span the entire Hilbert space in this way. But if you choose another bunch of mode functions, then you get the zero bar vector, and which is annihilated by the A bar operator, and then applying the A dagger operator multiple times, you get again a basis of the Hilbert space. It's the same Hilbert space by Stone von Neumann. But the bases are going to be different. Different mode functions, different bases, different A and A dagger operators. So, does the choice of mode functions matter? Well, in principle, it doesn't, right? Because any state of the system can be expanded in any basis, right? If you have a vector, in a Hilbert space, well, you can write it down as a linear combination of one basis or as a linear combination of another basis. Right? It doesn't really matter. So you can write down any state you want using any basis you want. And the field is, you know, decomposed in within one mode function, one set of mode functions, and the other mode functions all the same. In practice, however, it's often much more convenient to make one choice rather than another. So in particular, what usually guides people when they ask which mode decomposition should I use is that they say, I want a mode decomposition such that the corresponding A operator annihilates a vector, zero vector, which is, for me, the no particle vector, the vacuum state, right? And for that, what you need to do is first think about the physics of the vacuum state. You have to find out, how do I identify which state is the vacuum state? And once you figure out which state in the Hilbert space is the vacuum state, then you choose your mode decomposition such that the corresponding A operator annihilates that vacuum state. That's the most convenient mode decomposition for you then. Because if the A operator annihilates your vacuum state, then if you apply the A dagger K operator on it, you have a description of your one particle state. If you apply seven times the A dagger K operator, then you have a state that describes seven particles of momentum K. Now, you don't have to choose your mode decomposition with this motivation, but it's usually convenient. I mean, if you want to study the propagation of information through a quantum field, you may want to choose another mode decomposition. But in practice, it is convenient whenever we know which state is the no particle state, which is the vacuum state, let's say omega, to choose the mode functions uk such that the corresponding zero vector is what we know is the vacuum vector for us, is the no particle vector. So that, you know, ak on that is zero. Because then these vectors are the multiparticle states. Okay, let me give you an outlook of what's coming up. Let's say we know the system state, psi, is the vacuum state initially. Oh, by the way, let me just state this very clearly. I may have only implied it so far, so let me connect the dots and say it, spell it out explicitly. The vacuum state, by definition, we call that state the vacuum state, which for us, our observer, coordinate system or whatever, which for us is the no particle state. Okay? That's just a generally accepted definition that the vacuum state is a no particle state. The ground state may or may not be the same. The ground state is the lowest energy state. Now, the lowest energy state may not be the state of no particles. Okay, so for us, vacuum state is the no particle state. So let's say we know a system state psi is initially the vacuum state, which is to say, assume we know that initially we had no particles. So it's a vacuum state. Then we choose our mode functions appropriately, not because we have to, but it's very convenient, so that the corresponding zero vector is the vacuum state. And we call it the zero in vector in anticipation that, you know, a million years later, the universe may have evolved and may have created particles. And then a different vector in the Hilbert space might be the no particle state. But we are working in the Heisenberg picture, so our state is frozen. So the state of the system is frozen, but which state in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum state? That can evolve in time. So now after some evolution, for example, the universe expands, the vacuum state may have a different state, may be a different state, for example, chi. So then we choose a different set of mode functions, let's call it u bar, so that the corresponding a bar operator annihilates a vector zero bar, which is the vacuum state at this later time. So now we have two Hilbert bases, the one built on zero in and the one built on zero out. And there's going to be unitary transformation between them, just like the driven harmonic oscillator. Remember, at the beginning of the course, we had A in and A out operators, and there was a Bogoliubov transformation in between them. Similarly here, we now have an out basis and an in basis, and they're going to be related by unitary transformation. All of this is a little fast, but it's just an outlook. We're going to do this explicitly, of course, then. But you can already anticipate what will happen, namely that at late times, since we work in the Heisenberg picture, the system is still the in the state that we prepared it in, the Heisenberg picture after all. But while this state used to be the vacuum state early on, this is no longer the vacuum state late. And therefore, we have particle production. And we can find out how much by expressing that vector in the out basis. Because then we see that this vector has components not just in this direction, but also in the direction of the vectors of excited states. So there are also particles present. So therefore, we will be able to describe particle production, which arises from cosmic expansion. And that will be very similar to what we had earlier with the driven harmonic oscillator. There we had an external driving force, but here the excitation will not be external, but internal. It's not like the mode oscillators are externally driven by charges and currents. Now the mode oscillators are driven because their parameters, like the spring constant of the harmonic oscillator, that will be time dependent because of the expansion. And we will find weird stuff, namely that not only will it be time dependent in this way, that the harmonic oscillator potential, you know, changes shape like this, but mathematically it will also temporarily flip around, that we have an inverse harmonic oscillator. And of course, then stuff happens quickly once it's turned around. Right? This is as far as we got today. We're almost ready to do the cool stuff like the cosmology and black holes and so on. All right. Questions? Well, if there are no questions, then see you on Friday.